maiden. Isn't that fine?
Very fine, said Anna, dropping her gaze to the floor. Mrs. Wells seemed not to notice her discomfort.
No,
she said, sitting down at the settee and drawing the largest book towards her.
What is the date of your birthday, my dear?
Anna told her. Mrs. Wells drew back. She placed her hand over her heart.
No,
she said.
What? How terribly odd.
What's odd? Said Anna, looking frightened.
You have the same birthday as a young man. I just...
Lydia Wells trailed off and then said, suddenly,
How old are you, Miss Wetherill?
21.
21? And you were born in Sydney?
Yes, ma'am.
Right in town?
Yes.
Lydia Wells' expression was marvellous.
You don't happen to know the precise hour of your birth, do you?
I believe I was born at night, said Anna, blushing again. That's the way my mother tells it, but I don't know the precise hour.
It is astonishing, cried Mrs. Wells. I am astonished. The exact same birthday, perhaps even beneath the very same sky.
I don't understand, said Anna.
In a hushed tone of conspiracy, Lydia Wells explained. She spent her afternoons at a hotel upon George Street, where she gave astral predictions for a small fee. Her customers, for the most part, were young men about to make their fortunes on the goldfield. That afternoon, while Anna was enjoying her bath, she had given a reading to just such a man. The querent, so she described him, was also 21, and had also been born in Sydney upon the very same day as Anna. Anna could not make sense of Mrs. Wells' exhilaration.
What does it mean? She said.
What does it mean? Lydia Wells' voice dropped to a whisper.
It means that you may share a destiny, Miss Wetherill, with another soul.
Oh, Anna said.
You may have an astral soulmate whose path through life perfectly mirrors your own.
Anna was not as impressed by this as Mrs. Wells might have hoped.
Oh,
she said again.
The phenomenon is very rare, said Mrs. Wells. But I had a cousin with the same birthday as me, Anna said, and we can't have shared a destiny because he died.
It is not enough to share a day, said Mrs. Wells. You must be born at the exact same minute and at the exact same latitude and longitude. That is, under the exact same sky. Only then will your charts be identical. Even twins, you see, are born some minutes apart, and in the interim the skies have shifted a little, and the patterns have changed.
I don't know the exact minute I was born, Anna said, frowning.
Nor did he, said Mrs. Wells, but I shall lay my money upon the fact that your charts are identical, for we know already that the two of you have something in common.
What?
Me, said Mrs. Wells triumphantly. On the 27th of April, 1865, you both arrived in Dunedin, and you both had your natal charts drawn by Mrs. Crosby Wells.
Anna brought her hand up to her throat.
What? She whispered. Mrs. What?
Lydia Wells continued with the same enthusiasm.
And there are other correspondences. He was travelling alone, as you were, and he arrived this morning, as you did. Perhaps he made a friend by some accident of circumstances, quite as you did when you met me.
Anna was looking as though she might be sick.
Edward is his name. Edward Sullivan. Oh, how I wish I had brought him back with me. How I wish I had known. Are you not aching to make his acquaintance?
Yes, ma'am,
she whispered.
What an extraordinary thing, said Lydia Wells, gazing at her. It is most extraordinary. I wonder what would happen were you ever to meet.
Part 5. Waite and Lucre. The 12th of May, 1865. 45 degrees 52 minutes south, 170 degrees 30 minutes east, Dunedin. Silver. In which Crosby Wells makes a request. Lydia Wells is imprudent, and Anna Wetherill plays witness to a rather ugly scene. The mortification that Anna Wetherill had suffered upon discovering that the man whom she had entertained upon the afternoon of her arrival in Dunedin had been, in fact, the master of the house, only intensified over the weeks that followed. Crosby Wells was now installed in the rear bedroom of No. 35 Cumberland Street, and as a consequence, they saw each other every day. Anna Wetherill was painfully and perpetually conscious of the impression she created, and as a consequence of this abiding self-consciousness, her self-regard was critical to the point of fantasy. She had the inconsolable sense that there was something visible about her own character that she herself could not see, and this anxiety could not be appeased by persuasion, proof, or compliment. She was certain, when in conversation, that the unvoiced conclusions formed by those around her were both censorious and wholly apt, and because the shame she felt at this imagined censure was very real, she sought all the harder to court the good opinion of those whom she met, feeling as she did so that even in this project her intentions were all too visible. Believing herself uniformly criticized, Anna would have been very surprised to learn that the impressions others formed of her were not uniform in the slightest. The artless simplicity with which she most often spoke indicated to some that she possessed an alarming store of private opinions, the frank expression of which was even more alarmingly unfeminine. To others, her speech was entirely without artifice, and refreshing for that reason. Likewise, her tendency to squint upon the world was suggestive to some of fearfulness, and to others of calculation. To Crosby Wells, she was merely and very simply sweet. He found her frequent embarrassments very amusing, and had told her so more than once. "You do well in a camp, my girl," he said. "A breath of fresh air is what you are. Unspoiled. Nothing worse than a woman with a ready answer. Nothing worse than a woman who's forgotten how to blush." Lydia Wells, a woman with a great many ready answers and who very rarely blushed, had been only infrequently seen at No. 35 Cumberland Street since her husband's unexpected return. She left the house in the late morning, and often did not return until the dusk, when the gambling parlour opened for the night. Wells, in her absence, kept mostly to the first-floor boudoir, where the decanters on the sideboard were refilled daily. Drink softened him. Anna found that she liked him best in the late afternoons, when three or four glasses of whisky had turned him pensive, but not yet sad. Wells, it transpired, had no desire to return to the fields at Dunstan. Anna learned that he had made a strike of significant value the previous year, and he now desired to put that fortune to some use. He was considering various investments, both in Dunedin and beyond, and he spent a great deal of time poring